Thank you very much. I did mention an ad in USA Today. Just last week, USA Today won a very prestigious award from the New York City Press Club for Best Investigative Paragraph. I say, John, quite the contrary here, aside that what you've done has been a violation. I think that if one looks at the copy that John produces, which he does very prolifically, indeed, his editorials, his many articles, what is so good and makes them so interesting and so persuasive is that they're full of facts, that you are not simply spouting opinions, you're reporting, and you're getting information, and what is persuasive to most people is evidence, not simply opinions. So I think you're a very good example of what, indeed, we want our young people to do coming out of the program. One of the points that John stressed very correctly, I think, is that to have good journalism, you need not only technique, but substance. And substance is what is lacking, by and large, in the practice of the media today. Our next panelist is someone who addresses this problem very well indeed, in his own experience and what he's doing today. He brings to his activity background in working journalism, but he is also someone who is specialized in the substance of news, particularly with respect to East-West relations, national defense, security issues, and so on. He's a very, very impressive resume, not all portions of which I will read to you, but he was for a couple of years back in the 70s, a national fellow at the Cooper Institution and also a fellow at the National Endowment for the Humanities. He served as editor-in-chief of Welt am Sonntag in Hamburg, Germany. He then, from 1979 through 1983, was editor-in-chief of Axel Springer Publishing, a Jewish firm, and general manager of book publishing enterprise there. And beginning in 1983, he became both professor of international relations and professor of journalism at Boston University, where he came under the malign influence of John Silber and his flourishing. He became in 1986 the dean of the College of Communication at Boston University, and in 1988, director of the Center for Defense Journalism. To offer his insights into this topic, would you please welcome Mr. Joachim Matra. Joachim.
In my own defense, I may emphasize that I never did attend journalism school. And everybody in your fund, as you say. I intend to be very practical because I'm right in the field of training for journalists. I would like to slightly alter the topic and call it How to Make Conservatives Be Journalists, rather than the other way around. We have a spy here, a former student from our college is sitting right here, so I have to be guarded. They all report back to the alma mater. Our, this is Ms. Ryan, third row from the back. Watch her, please. The College of Communication has three departments, one for mass communication and public relations, one for broadcasting and film, and one for journalism being the smallest. Boston University has a student group which publishes a newspaper. It's called the Free Press. It is Boston's third largest paper, after the Globe, circulation half a million, and the Herald, 340,000. Free Press, issued entirely by students, has a circulation of 17,000 every day. 3 days prior to the elections, or rather the primary elections in Massachusetts, last Tuesday, the Free Press endorsed Bill Lottie. And John Silver, when being asked on television what he thought of that, he said, I'm of course not surprised, they hate their daddy. Needless to say, John Silver won, and when asked again on television what he thought of his lagging back by 12 points in public polls. He said, "Don't pay any attention to Sandinista polls." We have here in my boss, John Silver, the man who is not enthralled with the media, takes them on wherever he can, ignores all advice, and finally he doesn't know one anyway. I have a headline here from the Boston Globe, which says, the day after the debate in which he really misbehaved, scolding everybody, showing no friendliness towards anyone, "Dr. Silver, what you should do during your next campaign after you've lost this one, you should read Marshall McLuhan." The headline read, "Dr. Silver, you just don't get it." 5 days later, he won the primary. The topic I'd like to narrow even further by talking a bit about my own work, because I'm teaching. Most deans in America make a big mistake by not teaching. By not teaching, they become administrators, part of the establishment. Everybody complains that they don't teach because they can't teach. I teach regularly and therefore have a good opportunity to practice what I preach, namely competency. Of course, you never really talk conservatism, and I must also tell you, having a very strong libertarian strand in me, I am not quite sure that I would pass a litmus test on conservatism. So how do we actually work? Let me take an example from the present reporting on the war in the Middle East. Through our Center of Defense Journalism, which was founded 4 years ago and could not have been founded without strong support by the Oil Foundation, we have been enabled to issue a monthly newsletter. It's called Defense Media Review, and it is analytical in objective. We do take stories and pluck them apart, and I think we have proven on a few occasions that our defense press as such is not necessarily providing the American public with information competently acquired. About 10 days ago, the New York Times, our newspaper of record, had a page one story with a map in which the New York Times disclosed the location of American tactical aircraft and other aircraft all over the Middle East. For instance, F-16s in Saudi Arabia, F-16s in Qatar, FE-15 Strike Eagles in Oman, A-10s in Saudi Arabia, A-10s in the United Arab Emirates, and the like, and my conservative friends just hit the ceiling. This was work for the enemy, and under those circumstances, of course, Saddam had no reason to worry. He knew exactly what the Americans were up to. It's, of course, not true at all. It was a very superficial map, and did not contain the location of some aircraft the Americans had sent, our real trump cards in our strategic position, like the F-111s in Turkey, the F-4G Wild Weasels. And the issue, of course, was, why had Michael Gordon not revealed the locations of these aircraft? The answer was, of course, he didn't know. So I think it is quite good for the New York Times and the Washington Post to reveal as much as they can, because it forces our military to be even more tight-lipped. You are familiar with the fate of General Dugin not long ago, who really had been not only quite foolish, but also had shut himself into the heart, not just into the foot. I emphasize that in order to say, let's not be too sensitive. The journalist in the field is limited, extremely limited in his opportunities, and we should always be aware of the tremendous power the military has to hamstring them even more. As a defense journalist in the desert or in the jungles of Vietnam, you are, as a journalist, entirely dependent on the military. You cannot walk a foot without being grateful for those who guard you. You cannot move from one place to the other without a jeep provided by the military or a helicopter provided by the military. And yet, you may say now, why are they so ungrateful? Well, it is the job of the journalist, of the reporter in the field, to dig as deep as he can and to reveal to the public as much as he can. This may be upsetting to those who believe that the national security interest comes first, and of course it does. However, in an insight we all have to gain is that the journalist, per se, as a reporter, does not really have any power in the field. Many years ago in the 70s, Joseph Epstein wrote an essay in which he said, I hope you know it's like a good journalist, I have to search for what I want to read to you now. The message being, a journalist cannot really research anything properly, he's lacking all the means. He cannot subpoena, in other words, if you were to go to a three-star general in the desert and say, where do you have your wild wheel station? If the general tells him, he wouldn't tell him, you will not find out. In practical terms, again at Boston University, you have a freshman class numbering this year 285. You start a process of education which has not really started in high school, because it is focused very much not only on a profession, but on an accumulation of knowledge, what you would call a liberal education. We are not spending much time during the first 2 years, as Ms. Ryan will confirm, on teaching the basics of journalism. It would be an utter waste, because they do not know the basics of Western civilization. Normally, one can say that, even those with a very high SAT. The main issue is, of course, accumulation of judgment through knowledge. You cannot judge anything without knowing. That, to many young Americans, is new wisdom. Really, I shouldn't talk if I don't know the facts. That's correct. Keep your mouth shut. And they understand, normally, that this makes a lot of sense. Recently, we had a public showing of a few tapes dealing with the reporting of the war from the Middle East. There was this famous shot of Dan Rather sitting in the desert in a Banana Republic shirt, you know, collar up, little ascot. And he got very excited when a little vehicle appeared on the horizon and he said, our tanks are arriving. And he, of course, drew immediate hell, primarily from Tom Shale from the Washington Post, who said, Dan Rather, these are not your tanks, they are American tanks. And dutifully, Dan Rather apologized for having overly patriotic and said, yes, indeed, I should, of course, not have identified myself with these tanks. The issue being, of course, our journalists are not supposed to identify with the armed application of the national interest abroad. You see, they're just journalists and not Americans. You have to get across to a student generation, which is fairly innocent, that there is a very tricky issue involved in that, because these tanks, which, by the way, weren't tanks, they were light tanks called Sheridan. It was a crime to send them to Saudi Arabia, but that's all we had. Anyway, Dan Rather could have talked about that because they were his tanks. He is a very prominent, as you know, taxpayer. Now, I'd like to give you a little comparison. When the Falklands War broke out in 1982, a very limited number of British journalists, only British, if you were afraid you couldn't go, were invited by the Defense Department in London to accompany British troops. And one of them was Max Hastings, who is now editor-in-chief of a major British newspaper, thought about his job, going to the South Atlantic, courtesy of the Defense Department, and said, quote, I was British. This was a British war. I thought that, as one of only 20-odd correspondents reporting the war from the scene, I should tell the tale as sympathetically and, yes, as patriotically as I could. Now, right away, one thinks of American journalists storming the beaches of Normandy in 1944, thinking just that way. And apparently, America thought there was nothing wrong with it. Then something changed. When was that? Of course, it's Vietnam. Not Korea, it was Vietnam. I find a quote in Neil Sheehan's book, The Bright Shining Lie, in which he talks about himself and his attitude towards the military in America in Vietnam in 1963. Neil Sheehan was one of the three musketeers, one of them being David Halberstam, Martin Brown, and he, who had become the nemesis of Kennedy. They had reported all the wrong things from Vietnam, and as you may recall, those old enough to recall, Kennedy had actually asked the New York Times to recall Halberstam because he was not reporting in the national interest. The quote reads as follows. The American reporters shared the advisor's sense of commitment to the war. Our ideological prism and cultural biases were in no way different. We regarded the conflict as our war too. We believed, 1963, we believed in what our government said it was trying to accomplish in Vietnam, and we wanted our country to win the war just as passionately as the army did. This quote wasn't picked up by any of the reviewers because it does remind us of times in which an obligation of the journalist to be detached, objective, non-patriotic, was not recognized as binding. We went dumping on today's non-patriotic journalism generation should remember that government policy in Vietnam and in Washington had a lot to do with disenchantment. America did not fight a decisive war in Vietnam. There was no resolve, there was no love, and we all know the rest. As people say today, the rest is history. I jump. A year and a half ago, PBS produced a 12-part series, Ethics in America. It costs about $300 now to buy it. I thought it was excellent. Pages, parts. 6 and 7 deal with the military and ethics and America. Part number 7 is dealing with a scenario which I may briefly describe and what I do with it in the school. I have a captive audience, 285 freshmen. They have to attend, actually, the dean's freshman colloquium, where I abuse my power by occupying the lecture. I show them that film and ask them to write down in 2 sentences where they stood on the following scenario. An American journalist has been allowed by the troops of Kozan, North Korea, North Vietnam, synthetically combined, North Kozan, to travel with an armored unit in an Asian country. He finds out that this unit is about to ambush an American unit, battalion strength. And ambushing means you have a surprise element on your side. This American unit, numbering roughly 800, will be wiped out. What will the journalist do? Will he jump off the tank and try to warn the Americans? By whichever means, will he simply jump off and disappear into the jungle, not wishing to see what's going to happen? Or will he stay on the tank with a camera crew, calmly filming the event as contemporary journalistic ethics might require? Peter Jennings was asked that question by a lawyer named Ogletree from Harvard. And Peter Jennings, visibly, for 11 seconds, was fighting it. And then he said, I guess I would warn our troops. And let me add that Peter Jennings is a Canadian, not an American. He would warn our troops, American troops, and he drew immediate fire, vicious fire, from Mike Wallace, who was also on the panel, and said, you are violating the journalism code, that you are not involved in any way. You will, of course, stay, and I would with my crew, and film the event as it develops, and then show it on the American evening news. And now, in another development, Peter Jennings, chewing on his lower lip, says, well, I guess, Mike, I guess I folded. I guess, I would also stay and do my journalistic job. I apologize for having shown a weak spot. On the panel also is a Marine Corps colonel, Major Connell, whose contempt is growing. You can see it, the camera is in there. Yeah, he says, yes, I understand. You're not Americans, you're journalists, right? Yeah, I understand. And the next day, you two guys, you will be in the field of fire between Cozumel and my own lives. And you get shot up and you are whining and you will yell, help, Marines, come get us, and we will get you. We will come and we will rescue you, and because it's our duty to rescue Americans. Memorable, very memorable. And then, of course, you switch on the lights after those 12 minutes and the class is done for. until about 70, 30, they would want the Americans. But there already are the cynics who know they really don't have any obligation to the American units. Collect all this, you put it aside, and then you say, all right, the next scenario, if you know what logic means, is as follows. In the following scenario, I owe to Richard Grenier of the Washington Times. This is now the Middle East. Dan Rather is in Baghdad interviewing Hussein, Saddam Hussein. You may have seen that so-called interview. Very wimpy. She didn't ask a single tough question, but after all, he was dealing with the enemy, so he had to be respectful. And as he is in Baghdad in his hotel, he finds out that the Iraqis will launch a poison gas attack on American units of the 82nd Airborne across the border in Saudi Arabia. 82nd Airborne numbers 8,000. Poison gas on 8,000, in all likelihood, will mean 5,000 killed instantly. Will Dan Rather take the telephone and warn somebody in New York or elsewhere that this attack is imminent? And of course, you have this sound go through the freshman body. Oh my God. Isn't he driving it now too far? And of course, I'm driving it very far. But this is a moment of truth. Will Dan Rather go to the telephone? Or will he calmly stay in his hotel, get his camera group organized, helicopter in Russian helicopters on loan, and film the poison gas attack and show it on the evening news? Make long story short, you now ask the students for a vote, and lo and behold, everybody says the journalist, the American journalist, has an obligation to warn the American troops. Journalism ethics do not include his duty to stay out of this one, because this is, if I may misapply the term, Holocaust. And then, of course, Richard Grenier, and you all know him, comes up with a real conclusion. He says, what do I, Richard Grenier, journalist, American, what do I do upon finding out that they are about to catch Dan Rather in Baghdad? The Iraqis want to hang him. Now, what do I do? And then, of course, he said, I guess I'll be very tempted to wait objectively, detach professionally, to see him dangled by the neck. So, in the entire debate, you do not have to talk once about conservatism or liberalism. You really talk ethics. And while the term journalism ethics is used quite often in liberal schools, it is never interpreted this way. You are never driven to the extreme. My final comment, what else do we do in order to make points of professionalism? My commencement speaker last May was Richard Harwood from the Washington Post, the Ombudsman. Now, on purpose, I invited somebody from the Washington Post. I never talked about political leanings. It wasn't necessary. I just introduced him by quoting a few things from Richard Harwood, primarily his characterization of the press in America today as a Teflon estate. We said there is no guild more influential in America today than us, because under the guide and the umbrella of the First Amendment, we really get away with murder. Any sense. But what you do, you take such a column, you blow it up. Technology, as you know, enables us to do these things. You blow it up, post it on the dean's notice board, and say that copies are available in the dean's office. And within about 2 days, 500 copies are gone. I don't know where they go, but they are gone. Quote, errors of substance in the American media today ought to be minimal. Through technology, mathematical and statistical achievements, and advances in physical and social sciences, a marvelous machinery of record has been created. We can tell you promptly and precisely the amount of money in circulation, what Mikhail Gorbachev said in Minsk, the temperature in Bombay, the depths of the oceans, and the distances to the stars. We do these things well. When we stumble, it is usually from dealing in opinion, assumptions, stereotypes, superstitions, and prejudices. And he
post-mortal event. All descriptions of personalities of sincerity, aspiration, motive, intention, and of mass feeling are eventually questions of character. And now to include television and what television has done to today's interpretation of journalism, a quote from a book that, again, I recommend, although I did not write it. It is written by a professor of sociology and journalism of Duke University. Quote, "Bluntly speaking, the media now provide an overwhelming temptation for politicians and other political figures to engage in demagoguery, a term that has gone out of fashion even as the practice has been virtually institutionalized. Other forces besides the media create incentives for political opportunism, but demagoguery does feed on the biases of the news for the simple and symbolic, for the appearance of power and popularity, and against any sign of ineffectiveness or public disfavor. The media's vulnerability to manipulation winds up discouraging leaders from telling the public complex or painful truth." I have to close on a note on John Silver, who's fighting this. In his entire campaign, he wouldn't give an inch, and of course everybody told him, in this society you must give inches and yards all the time, you must compromise, you must not defend the media. You are really leading the war against the media. And he said, that's right, that's right. And when recently he was again misrepresented, he attacked in a 7-minute harangue an interviewing news team from Channel 7 in Boston, concluding, not letting them talk for 7 minutes, concluding, "You are just a bunch of phonies." Now, to conclude really now, towards young Americans wishing to study a subject, we normally avoid the term training because it is not really our job on the college level to train journalists to become good writers. We train them and teach them to be good writers. The majority will end up, thank God, in the spirit. So our job as such is really intellectual, moral, rather than trade. In America, strangely enough, trade training takes place in so-called graduate schools. The Columbia School of Journalism on the graduate level teaches the way you normally teach a 12-year-old how to write a copy. Why this ever came about, I don't know. I'd like to conclude with that and invite you to come up and ask me the title of the book I've just quoted from. Thank you.